Shalom and welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. We are in beautiful Pardes Institute here in Talpiot, Jerusalem. And I'm joined by Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. Good to see you.
Shalom, and also shalom to the Land of Israel Network. Great network with great stuff. And I want to tell you that I've been enjoying your recent two podcasts that I listened to. With regarding to Moses Mendelssohn and modernity, and really enjoying it a lot.
We are into the live stream now.
Yeah. It's right, exactly. I think I know what you mean, which is like you're now touching the now.
Yes.
Or how now has become now.
Exactly, the world in which we live.
When did then become now?
Ooh.
When will then be now? Soon. Where's that from? Do you remember? It's a great little shtick from Spaceballs.
I was going to say, it sounds like a Mel Brooks.
Yeah, Mel Brooks, that's right. A great little gig. Any case, speaking of then and now, today is the Land of Israel. Today is a kind of birthday for the Land of Israel. It's really the birthday of the trees. The trees, because I speak for the trees.
I was going to say, before there was a Lorax, at least there was a birthday.
That's right. There's cultural references flying here today,
woo!
Folks. I want to tell you that it is Tu B'Shvat today, and I feel it. You may be listening to the show post-Tu B'Shvat, but I absolutely give listeners the permission to feel the Tu B'Shvat energy a little bit longer. That's right. You got to sink roots. We'll talk about that in a second. For me, very special day on many levels. First thing, I want you to know that my grandfather, who survived the... The siege of Leningrad.
I knew you got it from somewhere.
Yeah, he was the toughest guy. My grandfather, the toughest dude, and really, and I mean, a little too tough. He was very, very tough dude, and he wasn't even such an easy person to deal with in his life for me.
Your father's father.
My mom's dad, uh-huh. and I was close to him in the sense that I lived here for many years while there was no other family, and he was partially estranged. Whatever it is. Long of family history. But the bottom line is that he passed away on Tu B'Shvat.
Ah, Baruch Atah Amen.
This was a few years ago.
Of course.
When we were burying him and dealing with his belongings and stuff, and we found his Tudat Zehut, his Israeli ID, it turned out that he was born on Tu B'Shvat.
Wow.
Born on Tu B'Shvat. Passed away on Tu B'Shvat.
One of the signs of the righteous.
That's right. And the truth is that Grandpa Mordechai, he had rescued a few people in Leningrad in the siege and did a few acts of courage that are well known in the family. And since he was a quiet person about these things, then there was others probably. He just saved a lot of people's lives by just bringing them food and other things that were just... and he was just known to be tough. He was just known to be tough and push back on bad guys. Never agreed to be a communist. Was never in the Communist Party and still was wealthy in Russia and was a manager of factories and stuff, but never agreed, even under the Soviet Union, to be a Communist Party member. Taught my mom how to get through the KGB with all kinds of tactics that my mom has bequeathed onto me as well, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's one thing. Second thing is that I remember very well that I was at a wedding in Brooklyn on Tu B'Av, and Malka and I were there, and it was 6 months before our own wedding. And we looked at the big fat moon of Tu B'Shvat because it is a full moon. And on Tu B'Shvat and Tu B'Av, there are big moons in the sky. They're just like these big moons. This year happened to be scientifically it was a big moon. It was like a blue moon, which was the second day's full moon. It was a red moon. It was a blood moon. It was a bad moon rising. I don't know what it was.
Okay, it was big. I saw it.
Yeah, it was out there.
It was out there.
Big. It was big in the sky. And there's something about it. Now, I've heard from Kabbalah people that they say, there's really, we think of four seasons, right? But there are really two seasons. The summer season and the winter season. Mm-hmm. There's like the cold time and the warm time.
That's certainly the way it is in Israel.
Right. And basically, Tu B'Shvat and Tu B'Av are exactly at these 6 months apart.
Right.
And they just, there's like a toggled switch, and now we're like heading towards summer.
Ooh, not too quickly, Lord.
Yeah, you want a little bit more winter, right?
Oh, I would love a lot more winter.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from the fact that I live somewhere where in the summer it's too hot to go outside.
Right.
Right. There's just the fact that, you know, one of the things that the Gemara says is that on Tu B'Shvat that we've had Rov Gishamim, we've had the majority of the rains, which
right.
Even though, thank God, that our prayers have been answered in the last month, we could use quite a bit more.
Yeah, I always, in the last years here in Eretz Yisrael, have been feeling that winter is just not, it's not satisfying. It doesn't winter fully. And that's
that should be a cause for reflection.
Yeah, yeah. We need the winter to be more robust, and we pray to God for that. Okay, Tu B'Shvat is also, you know, Arbor Day. It became very linked up with the Kabbalists of Tzfat, and later on with the Zionists. They all teamed up kind of in different periods to see this as an important day, because it was kind of turned from just a way of counting the years of the trees.
Which has a lot to do with the mitzvot that are dependent upon the land of Israel.
Right.
I mean, it's not just a counting, right? One of the most sort of powerful and intimate aspects of the relationship between the people of Israel and the land of Israel is the fact that there are certain commandments which can only be fulfilled when the two meet, specifically through agriculture. And I don't want to get into the details of it, but that depends on a seven-year cycle, which people may be familiar with as a sabbatical cycle. And that itself depends on watching the trees and when the fruit comes to fruition, and the marker for that is today. Each year passes
right.
for the trees today.
So if a tree was planted yesterday, it would be considered as though it passed a year today.
Well, when we get into the fact that it has to actually have 30 days to root, etc., but it's more or less, yes.
Okay. So, but it was taken from that, let's pull like a kind of legal category, to having a broader meaning, which is the rooting of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, the flowering of our redemption, etc. Tu B'Shvat became a kind of a broader consciousness day.
Yeah, I mean, it has for 1,000 years. What's fascinating to me about Tu B'Shvat is that it's a wide open day, and literally since the time of the Gaonim, right, the great leaders of the Babylonian academies, we're talking about 1,000 years ago, if not more. They already began to tie Tu B'Shvat together with their aspiration for the flowering of the land of Israel. And then, as you said, the Kabbalists 500 years ago and the Zionists only 100, 150.
Yeah, they all tied into this day. And I was thinking about the metaphors of planting and growing. And I was, as I was praying this morning, I was just thinking about, let's just go through it. I was thinking about people's, praying for people's health.
Mm-hmm.
Refuah, that blessing. And then I was thinking, I have some people that I'm praying for that I've never had children. And then I imagined in my mind that I prayed for these people to be fruitful.
Yeah.
To be fruitful. And after that came the blessing of the years, the blessing for the...
Right,
the sustenance and abundance. And, you know, I saw in my mind's eye the land of Israel sustaining the people of Israel and welfare, the rain.
Abundantly, it's all tied, yeah.
Right? After that, kibbutz galiot, right? And kibbutz and the gathering. Right, in gathering of the exiles. And first I saw like these like flying dandelions. What do you call those things? Those, the little saba, the...
Oh, yeah. I don't know what to call them.
You know, those things that fly, those little paratroopers.
In America, they were dandelions that had dried out. Now right. I mean, right? You blow on them and they
Of imagined them being like ingathered. Or then I thought to myself of ingathering of like wheat, ingathered into the land of Israel.
A little bit of herding cats.
Right. Don't talk about cats. We had the cat scratch incident.
We had the story last
week. There's a lot of sensitivity in my house about that right now. So let's just stay away from cats right now.
I dropped.
It's not, yeah. Cats is not on Broadway and... And I don't want cats scratching my... I saw cats on Broadway one time. It was the worst. forget it. I don't want to talk about it. I'm not in a cat place. The next blessing that I thought of after Kibbutz Galiot was the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And judgment, I don't remember how I tied it in my head, but I think it was that... help me think about that. Like, where's the... I remember what it was. I thought to myself, judges. I thought judgment comes from good judges. And I thought of these wizened olive trees, right? These like wise...
You know, there's a verse in the Psalms, the Azranu Atayara, Lifnei Hashem Ki Ba Lishpot Ha'aretz, right? That the trees will rejoice before God because he's come to judge the land.
Right.
And it's always a big question to me, what's the connection between trees and judgment? And I think part of what it is that trees, like all other plants, but in a much more powerful way, they always grow up toward the light. Meaning you can bend a tree, you can block it, you can do all kinds of stuff, but they grow upward toward the light. And that is a very important image, I think, for us for justice, is that life throws blockages and history, you know, may bend your ways. But our purpose as a people is to always grow toward sort of that sense of being upright.
Right. And I also, because in Hebron, where I work, we have these beautiful, old, wizened olive trees. And I just saw them as these judges.
Mm-hmm.
You remember?
Because they've seen things.
Yeah, they've seen things, and they just have a wisdom to them. And I thought to myself, oh, Israel, if you would have only these kind of great judges in Jerusalem, again, you know, this type of, you know, wisdom that the Jewish people have. Then I thought about the Rishaim, the evil people. And we have the blessing of the heretics against the heretics and the foes of Israel. And one of the words there is te'aker. They should be uprooted.
Yes.
I thought to myself, don't, and I face these people all the time. We face these people all the time, but I face them, I see them in Hebron, like, God, don't give them any sustenance, this land. Don't give them any sustenance. Like, uproot these people. Like,
yes, let them have no hold.
Right, and if you ever see a plant that's uprooted, it's like this pathetic thing that you no longer have.
It's got no future.
It's got no future. It's over, you know, and I'm just like, just detach them. Just detach them, oh God, you know. And again, thinking about Tu B'Shvat, like, give the sustenance of the right things. Next one is the righteous. And here, as opposed to the blessing of the righteous, I'm talking, of course, about the 18 benedictions prayer that has a certain format. I'm going through it partially. I thought to myself about the righteous, and instead of envisioning them like the judges who were olive trees, I thought to myself, oaks, these big oaks, these sequoias, you know, these giants of mankind, these giants. And I thought to myself, you know, may we see giants rise up. And sometimes people say we don't have great giants in our time. I think we do. They might be more hidden.
Yeah, I also think part of that is because we don't want them. I mean, I really think that the individualism and the desire to sort of like, I'm okay, you're okay, leave me alone, don't tell me what to do,
right,
makes it very hard for there to be spiritual leadership of stature like that. Another image there for you in the righteous is tzadik katama yifrach, right? That the righteous flourish like a palm tree, which to me is very important, in particular in light of our history and even bits of our present situation, is that, you know why date palms produce such sweet fruit? Because they grow in bitter soil. And it's actually, I don't want to get into the science of it, but the uptake of brackish water forces the tree to increase the sugar content of the fruit. Right, and it's a metaphor for how it is that we as the Jewish people have constantly produced such amazing things through time with a history which could look quite bitter. Right, that the ability to sort of uptake and absorb the bitterness of life and transform it into sweetness is the aspect of the righteous.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a deep thought to think about, and Israel has consistently faced bitterness,
and produced great
right,
dates.
great stuff. And then the kind of cornerstone of it is Jerusalem. That's the next blessing, and you know, the seeing Jerusalem being rebuilt, and I'll just tie it right to the next verse, the next blessing, which is the real Tu B'Shvat blessing, which is right. May God that David's kingdom, the Messianic kingdom, it is compared to in the book of Isaiah to this flowering reed, this root, this shoot that comes out, right? That shoot of Jesse, the reed of Jesse.
And one of the names of Mashiach is Tzemach, is right, that sprouting, which is one of the reasons that we pray when we pray for the state of Israel, we pray for Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, the beginning of the flowering or the sprouting of our redemption.
You know, Rabbi Mike, when a sapling takes root, you think to yourself, I got to protect this little thing. If you ever seen them grow olive trees here in Israel in the windswept areas, they've got these kind of plastic
sleeves,
housings,
right, yeah,
sleeves, and it's ginger, it's fragile, and it can get messed up early,
sure,
you know. But then at some point, it becomes an olive tree, and once it's an olive tree, you're like, wow, you can't mess with this thing. It's really strong. If it's growing up right and it's got the bark is going good, the roots are going good, it just has a grip and a hold to it. And from then on, it becomes something else. Then it becomes really making it the bigness that it can be. And then afterwards, actually...
flowering and fruiting.
Right. And taking from those fruits, you know, correctly. So that's what I feel like we're in the stage here in the land of Israel. It's like we're not any longer the sapling. I could hear the echoes of 1948 and 1967 and all the wars where it was like fragile. There wasn't a for sure foregone conclusion. Now I see that this thing is robust.
So there's a very parallel process. I once asked one of my teachers, if you read the book of Joshua, right? There's this sort of incredible sense of purpose and unity and strength that the children of Israel project. And then you kind of turn the page to the book of Judges, and you say, what happened? Like, everything's falling apart. There's civil war. There's cultural collapse. There's idolatry, you know? And so I asked one of my teachers about this, and what he said, I think, was very wise. He said, listen, striking root in the land of Israel demands every ounce of spiritual, moral, and physical energy that the people have. But once you strike root, even though it may be followed by a period of dissolution, as you're pointing out, the root is there, and so therefore the growth will follow, because what comes out of the chaos of Judges, of course, is the kingdom of David. And so I very much feel that we as people are in a parallel situation now. I mean, the early generations, to say that they struck root is a gross understatement. I mean, they busted through solid rock. You know, they had to uproot themselves from another world and bust through solid rock here to really strike root. And I feel like a lot of the sort of the skepticism and the pessimism, which passes as sophistication in the culture of our country today, is kind of that passing phase of that happened in the book of Judges. You can imagine there were people in the time of the book of Judges looking around saying, nah, Zeloze. Like, this isn't it. We didn't come here on behalf of God and all that stuff. And it's kind of like, okay, fine. You want to judge by the surface events, so you'll judge. But just know we have struck root. And that the tree which will grow from this, as we've been promised, will actually make the kingdom of David pale in comparison.
Amen. I drove into Yerushalayim this morning. It's just like, this thing is, this, it's rich.
It's booming.
It's booming. I could feel it. I could feel it. You know, and the blessing that we give, the Sephardi people a lot of times give one another is, and you see it in some of the texts, which is that you should have right? You should have roots in the ground. Those are hidden things, and make fruits above. Also, I remembered what it says in Pirkei Avot, which is, it compares wisdom. It says if a person who has more wisdom than actual actions, right? He's compared to a true tree that is maybe big and robust.
Many branches, few roots.
Right, few roots, and gets toppled over.
Boom.
And so I want to bless everybody that's listening today, that you should have make a great root below, great fruits above, and those roots should be bigger than the actual tree, meaning to say the grip on this world of doing great things. Yes, it's important to understand, but more important than take that understanding and turn that into great actions. And I want to bless people with that. And I also want to bless you, Rabbi Mike, and every listener, but especially I want to bless you with a great etrog. Today, the B'nai Issachar famously says, today's a day to pray for a great etrog. I want to wish you to have a great etrog. And I love the idea of like being like, oh yeah, that thing that's like more than half a year away, like I'm planting the seed for it now. Wait a minute, how long is that away? Wait a minute, how long does that come out?
It's more than, because it's 6 months from Pesach.
It's
6 months from Pesach. From Pesach to Sukkot is 6 months.
Right. So then.
So it's
plus eight, another 2 months.
It's 8 months.
It's 8 months. Well, that's a totally viable child. You see, you know, we're planting it right now. And also, speaking of that, I do want to pray that people have, that all of you will find a great etrog or connect to a great etrog, even if you're a Gentile and you have no commandment for an etrog, for a citron fruit and for the four species, you know, come into a sukkah this year. And those people who haven't been blessed with children yet, I want to, you know, send you also a blessings for a great etrog. And all of us who do have children and are still raising them, they should come out to be without blemish and come out to be a beautiful fruit, all these things. Anyway,
amen.
Yeah, I just had this like real feeling that we have to talk about this thing of blessing each other with a great etrog. Okay. Now, Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much for joining me on the Yishai Fleischer Show here in Jerusalem, Pardes Institute, Land of Israel Network. I also want to thank, by the way, I want to thank our good friend Zev Stubb at Janglo.net, who puts out a great etrog for all of us, which is this incredible website that gives you all the information that you need to make it here in the land of Israel. So thank you very much, Zev, and check out Janglo.net. If you're in Israel, you certainly need it. If you're on the way to Israel, it'll make you feel a lot better about coming here, and you could already start asking questions of this incredible community. And I'm also very excited about northisrael.com/Yishai.
Nippy.
That's right. We talked about it last week. People got excited about it. I think that.
I, by the way, clarify with Shmuel. He said I could have free lunch if I come.
Like yes, there were a few people who turned to me and are like, "Can I also have free lunch?" All kinds of freeloaders. Okay, okay. So that's yeah. If you check out northisrael.com/Yishai, put in your name there, you're going to get a great explanation about your opportunities. You get free lunch up in the north, and it's really a hidden gem, an opportunity for people to actually sow your roots in the land of Israel. Sow your roots in the land of Israel. And the truth of the matter is that no matter how much I try to sell to you to check out northisrael.com, just type in into Google like Northern Israel and then hit images. And then that'll speak
for
itself.
That's a good sales pitch.
Right. Just check that out for yourself. Okay. Now we're going to get to the Torah portion of Yitro. I have to tell you that I listened to the whole Torah portion of Yitro as explained by Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinrib. I think he's the former or emeritus president of the OU. Old school awesomeness, really, like old school awesomeness. He was having me giggle this morning at 4 a.m. when I was washing dishes. I was giggling.
If you could make somebody giggle at 4 a.m. while they're washing dishes, that's an accomplishment.
Yeah, I was just like, I said to him, without him being there, I'm like, I hope you know that you just made a dude in Judea happy at 4 a.m. because you made me giggle. Because he was like, because he's a real old schooler, and he's like, when it says about, you know, I brought you here on wings of eagles. So he's like, Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Eibster is kevayachol, hanging out in Sinai. Just the way he said hanging out. I don't know. he's an elderly gentleman, but totally with it. Any case, the Torah portion is Yitro. Jethro. This is one of the most awesome names for a Torah portion, okay? Because this is the Torah portion that should be called Moses Gives You the Torah, okay? Moses brings down the Torah. But instead, we're going to start with something completely different, which is Jethro, the famous father-in-law, well depicted in Prince of Egypt as a jolly, kind of wise, you know, man of plumpiness. And he, this jolly, robust man of wisdom, is the father-in-law of Moshe, and he comes to see Moses as they're parked close to the mountain of God at Sinai. He brings his wife and his two sons, who were not sent away, but basically on the way down to Egypt, they were kind of told to return, because why are you bringing, as Aaron kind of says in the Midrash and the Rashi, why would you be bringing down your wife and kids?
We're trying to get the ones that are there out.
Right. So do us a favor. Here comes Yitro, and basically two things happen. The first thing that happens is that Yitro, the first thing, the term father-in-law is repeated over and over and over again. He is the father-in-law of Moses. Get it? And there's honor being given to this man. Mm-hmm. And this man is told the story of the Exodus, of the splitting of the Red Sea, and also of the war of Amalek.
Yep.
And he either has the shivers, the shudder or goosebumps, because it has this word vayichad that he either brought it all together, understood it as one, or he had goosebumps, being like so wowed by this tale, right?
Yeah.
And he was so wowed by this tale that he basically blessed God, and right there and then he's in this conversion process. It doesn't say the word he converted. It doesn't say that.
That's because it would be, I think, an anachronism at this point. I mean, they're standing there at Sinai after coming through the Red Sea. It's a time where the world has an opportunity to choose sides, basically. And this is what Midian really represents. And Yitro, of course, is the leader of Midian. It's what Midian really represents throughout the Chumash, is the ability of the world to either see or not see God's presence in the history of Am Yisrael. And Yitro represents that face of the nations of the world who, when they see Israel coming out from Egypt, standing at Sinai, they say, yes, this is real. And so that's why he's such a critical, you know, personality in the process of giving the Torah. Because in the end of the day, if the Torah were given to Am Yisrael and we kept it to ourselves, we would fail in our purpose. Right, it's bound up with the fact that really the Torah is God's plan for all creation. And as part of that plan, there's a people who are meant to carry it. But if there weren't, in that first moment of receiving it, also some participant of the nations of the world who could be there to see it and sort of receive it as well, then it would lose its purpose.
Right. So Yitro is, on some level, the universalist element in this particularist moment.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay, and he says, here's verse, we're talking about the book of Exodus, chapter 18, verse 9. Jethro rejoiced over all the good that Hashem had done for Israel, and that he had rescued it from the hand of Egypt. Jethro said, "Blessed is Hashem, who has rescued you from the hand of Egypt and from the hand of Pharaoh, who has rescued the people from under the hand of Egypt. Now I know that Hashem is greater than all the gods, for in the very manner which the Egyptians had conspired against them," the end of the verse is that it came back to them in the very manner that there was karma here, right?
It's a messy verse in the original, that one.
Right. Well, I find it easier than the English, you know. Ki badavar asher zadu alehem, because they got it. They got punished on the very thing that they planted. They planned to drown your children. They themselves were drowned. And that God had basically, the explanation is that God had meted out punishment measure for measure.
That's a critical idea that's worth it just to pause for a second, that this notion of midah keneged midah, that God acts measure for measure, I think is often misunderstood as sort of like almost a petty, vengeful God. He's like, oh, you did that? Well, I'm going to do that right back at you, right? But I think the deeper understanding is that we don't live in some passive world. Right, the way that God has presented creation to us is it responds to our actions. So therefore, the way you walk in the world is the way in which the world responds. So therefore, if you do evil in the world, one hopes that the world will respond in kind and vice versa.
Right. That's why I have a bone to pick with Gandhi.
Uh-huh.
Okay, there's something that Gandhi once said which always like...
It's the second time it's come up in the last 2 weeks.
It just irks me. It irks me. I wish I could... I don't know if he was a guy that you could talk to or not. I don't know. You know, I just don't know how his personality
we
really
never
was.
Met, yeah.
But like that whole, like that phrase that he says, well, an eye for an eye will only leave the world blind. It really, first thing, God bless you, Gandhi. You're awesome. And everybody, you know, respects the fact that you're like an angelic type person in this world. But like,
he's
ripping the Bible.
He's lost some shine lately.
Yeah,
but.
Ripping the Bible. Oh, has he?
Yeah, we don't get into it.
I might have missed that story. You know, ripping the Bible, that is just not like the wise man's thing to do.
Listen, not only that, but frankly, our sages were aware of that problem before he ever said it, right? It's one of the courses one of my colleagues here at Pardes teaches about the relationship between the written and the oral law that he calls blind and toothless, right? Because the sages right away said that's not actually possible to have justice in that sense. That's not what God intended. You know, but what it is to find a way in their minds through monetary damages to make an equivalency of loss and recompense.
My father, Alav Shalom, said to me, and I always think this was absolutely right. He said, "The law, the judgment that mankind is given, is in order to void this kind of punishment and to extract it through monetary and other means."
Yes,
but if that doesn't happen, karmically. Right, in this world, there is a system which will extract that judgment.
I sure hope so.
Right, he's like, and it says so. It says so also in we have a famous in the ethics of our fathers in Pirkei Avot. Like, you know, he sees the I think it was Hillel. He sees that skull floating by. He says,
"Yes,
you drowned a dude.
You drowned those, and those who drowned you will themselves be
right.
drowned.
You drowned somebody, and you got drowned, and those who drowned you, they too will be drowned." I mean, today there is a system in this world. And it's out there. It doesn't mean that you should extract an eye. You have to be a little bit more, shall we say, a little bit more finesse. I give you a way to do it.
Well, it's deeper than just finesse. It's a question of what judgment really is in the hands of man. I mean, in God's judgment,
I didn't really mean finesse.
To God.
I meant do it. Here's your way to do it. We don't want you to take out an eye.
It's because our conception of judgment is limited.
Also, can I tell you something? This morning I read an article which really disturbed me.
Uh-oh.
It was one of those moments.
Stop reading the news.
Yeah, but it was one of those moments where, like, it's like, don't click it, don't click it, don't click it, don't click it. And I don't fall for that stuff a lot. You know, I don't have a lot of, like, internet yitz or hurrah, but, like, here I had a moment.
Thank God.
We all have of it, though, but sure. Some level. But here was a, you know, here was there was an article about a guy in Texas who is going to be put to death by lethal injection. The guy murdered his wife and was sentenced to, I don't remember, 27 years prison, got out on parole on the eighth year, had a girlfriend, and murdered her. And it was just like, and it was just like, the worst part about it also, our rabbis tell us, there's a commandment not to look at the face of evil people.
Yeah.
And my friend, Rabbi Hillel Fendel told me one time, he's like, the reason is because when you look at the face of evil people, they don't look so evil.
Right.
And that could really fool you. You can mess you up.
Interesting.
He's like, and just now I saw a picture of Mahmoud Abbas together with the King of Jordan, the so-called King of Jordan, please. I do not recognize there's a kingdom there at all. The so-called Bedouin King of Jordan.
Hashemite, please.
Yeah, it's a total fake kingdom. Anyway, and they're smiling, hugging each other, sweet guys. And I'm just like, you're two Rasha'im. You are Rasha'im. You are evil people, both of you. Don't give me your little smug little faces. You are, forget even how bad you are to the Jews. You are the most corrupt two leaders, really. You're such a bunch of thieves. And it's like, I have to look at your smiling little faces on the front.
I'm going
to
give you a smile for this. When my brother, during the war in Iraq, was stationed in Amman for a while as a journalist.
Sure.
And he and his partner kept sending back these stories about the king, because that's all the news in Jordan. Except he's super short. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
He's tiny. Right. So they kept writing Abdullah, the midget, in their copy. And the editors, you know, of course, they knew the editors were taken out. But finally, he got in jail. They were like, listen, if we miss this once, we're through. Like, stop writing that.
Behind the scenes in journalism. Okay, here's something also. You're laughing now. I'm going to also laugh a little bit. I thought to myself, nobody can be the ultimate Rebbe. Who's the ultimate Rebbe? Who is the ultimate Rav? Who is the ultimate Rabbi? Moses is the ultimate Rabbi.
I would say the Holy Baal Shem Tov, but okay, that was my second guess.
Come on, number one Rabbi, the Rabbi of Rabbis, the number one, the King of the Jews.
He was the father of the prophets before he was the Rabbi of Rabbis.
Okay, but he's the giver of the law, the father of the prophets.
Absolutely,
Moses. Okay,
yeah.
Moshe Rabbeinu.
Yeah,
that's his name.
Well, he was Moshe Ava Nevi'im before he was
Ava Nevi'im. Fine, no problem. Not trying to take it away, right? Now, you're the man, you're the man. The Torah you're filled with four books of Moses out of five. It's you.
Yep.
And the last book is your whole soliloquy. Yes. You're going to be called amazing accolades.
No one will ever be like you.
Nobody will ever be like you. The most humble man who ever worked this earth. But even Moses needs a Rebbe. Even Moses needs a Rav. Even the highest dude. And this is so funny. This Torah portion where the Ten Commandments are brought down. First thing, your father-in-law has got to come into the picture and say,
you're wrong.
You're doing it all wrong. You're doing it all wrong. And it's just such an overt lesson. You know, it's like even whoever thinks they're great, first thing, all of us should always have greater people in our life.
And if we don't have them, then we should make ourselves humble and seek them out.
Right. Right, you must find greater people in your life. You must. Right. You must find that's the point of the story. Here's Moses. He's going to go up to the mountain of God and bring down the Torah. Comes his father-in-law and says, "You're doing it all wrong."
And there's a very powerful insight that we can gain in at least the way Rashi and a whole group of the commentators read the text, that this event with Yitro telling Moshe how to arrange the system of judgment actually chronologically takes place after the giving of the Torah. And there's lots of discussion. Well, if that's the case, why would the Torah present it first? And I think one answer is exactly what you said. Lest we come to think that Moshe had reached this pinnacle and there was nothing above him, first you're going to see that he was completely open to listening to his father-in-law and being wrong. And then we can get the story of the Torah, because that needs to be the context.
I just think that's amazing.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I just think that's amazing. And you know what? I would have thought that lesson could be like a side lesson, an important lesson, yes. But like the Torah portion where the Ten Commandments are given is called Jethro.
That's right.
The Goy, the Gentile, the guy who also experimented with every single, as Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinrib said, he says, he was a master of comparative religions. Okay? He was a master. He had, our sages tell us, he had tried every. He was an expert in every, including some of the most, you know, base and bizarre ones, you know. So anyway, he had become expert in all those. He had been there and done that, literally. Mm-hmm. And here he is. He gets to get the name on it. Anyway, what we were saying is that basically he sees Moses, and he sees him standing from after the receiving of the Torah, most likely. Although, in terms of
it's an argument between Rashi and the Ramban, but we don't even get to it right now.
Right. And so the what he does is he sees Moses standing. First thing, he slightly criticizes Moses. He's like, you're sitting and this whole nation is standing before you.
Yep.
And the subtle hint there is, they're standing and you're sitting, you're making these people stand all day. So obviously he was like trying to get rid of the red tape, fighting bureaucracy, and trying to make more
streamlining, justice.
Government. Right, exactly. Right?
A small government kind of guy.
Right.
Well, I mean, that no, would be true if it weren't for the fact that he then led to the appointment of you know, thousands of bureaucrats.
Right, but he also, but in some way, he basically says to Moses, you're the highest authority, but not the lowest authority. Like, create systems by which, and we'll also learn this about prophecy later on, not in this Torah portion, that Moses has to share some of his prophetic powers without losing any of his own, but he has to kind of pass it over. Also with rabbinics or decision-making, judgment, you've got to appoint people below you.
Well, there's a lot, I would say, in sort of organizational development and institutional wisdom we can learn here. But the one piece that's critical to take away if people don't know it is that you always want to run on program and not on personality. And that's what Yitro said to Moshe. He said to Moshe, listen, you could do this, but nobody else can. And you're going to go the way of all flesh. And where will these people be? Right? You got the Torah. This wasn't just Sinai. This is the rest of history. Build something which will last and build it on program and not on personality. Make it in a way where, from, like you said, that what really matters is the lowest authority, not the highest. Because that's what actually allows the people to integrate themselves into the Torah and for it to be lived as a national venture and not just as sort of like top-down prophetic vision.
And also, if the man goes, the whole thing might go down with it.
That's right.
Right?
That's why you build on program and right. Not on personality.
That's roots. It's Tu B'Shvat.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It's sorry. Roots. It's roots.
I was looking at the movie for some
like,
hours.
No, not that movie. No, like sink roots. You know, roots. Yeah. Have it be rooted in other people and in other people that are going to take part of it, and also in history. Rooted in history. Give it over to somebody else. And that's his father-in-law giving him a hard time. That's so great. You know, and Moses contemplates what Yitro Jethro tells him, and he accepts it. Immediately after that, by the way, just now that I'm thinking about it, this is exactly like Moses' early life, right? He fights for his brothers, right? And then the next thing that happens is that he goes to Midian, and there he rescues Jethro's daughters. When God sees that he rescued these girls, he gives him his first experience at Mount Sinai.
Right.
Which is the burning bush. Again a bush. It's Tu B'Shvat, right? and then subsequently, now we see again, right before the second kind of burning bush, if you will, the receiving of the Ten Commandments, again there's Jethro, again there's that universalist element, again there is him humbling himself
yes.
towards the greater vision, the greater truth that doesn't necessarily just reside in the Jewish people. There it is, okay? And then we go swiftly on to the actual receiving of the Torah. I just want to read one line here. Says to him, the father-in-law of Moses said to him, there's the father-in-law, the thing is that you do is not good, right? You love it when the father-in-law starts like
good.
That. You
not
love it.
Good.
What you're doing, nicht good. That's what he actually said. Actually, he said nicht good. Nicht good. After we learned about the schmearing of the doorpost, now there's a nicht good. The thing that you do is nicht good. You will surely become worn out, you as well, the people that is with you. For the matter is too hard for you. You will not be able to do it alone. Now heed my voice. I shall advise you, and may God be with you. You are representative to God, and you convey the matters to God. You shall caution them regarding the decrees and the teachings, and you shall make known to them the path that which they should do and the deeds they should do. And you shall discern from amongst the entire people men of accomplishment, God-fearing people, men of truth, people who despise money, and you shall appoint them. When we say despise money, we don't actually mean despise money. We mean despise
people who are not open to being bribed.
Right, exactly, because we're still Jews. And sorry, ooh, oh my God, oh no, ooh. Oh no, don't send me that email. I don't want the email.
Please send it to him.
And you shall appoint them over the people as leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, and leaders of tens. They shall judge the people at all times, and it shall be that they shall bring every major matter to you, and every minor matter they shall judge, and it will be eased for you, and they shall bear with you. If you do this thing, and God shall command you, I'm giving you advice, but I want you to check it vis-a-vis the Lord, then you'll be able to endure, and this entire people as well shall arrive at its destination in peace. You like that? Yavo al mekomo. Look, excuse me. Al mekomo yavo b'shalom. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, we take this as the way we speak to each other. We want to lech b'shalom and not lishalom, as we say, right? You're going in peace and not to peace, because right. going to peace is the final destination.
That's right.
And going in peace is yet another one of those phrases that we take from this sort of brief but very potent interaction that happens between Yitro and Moshe.
Yitro then leaves. He goes to convert his family, ostensibly.
Which is one of our triggers that there's a strange chronology going on here, because we find him later having not left yet, and then Moshe asking him to actually go into the land of Israel with them. But it's a very powerful notion that Rashi encapsulates in that phrase, "Ein mukdam u'mucha b'Torah." There is no before or after in the Torah. That in the end of the day, when we read the Torah, what's definitive is meaning and not sort of the narrative chronology. And it poses a lot of questions for how we're meant to read it, which is one of the reasons that there's an oral tradition around that. But it also, I think, addresses a lot of the confusion people have in the text and its unity, right? That it was the text was deliberately presented to us in a way in which it's not obvious how it should be read, which is just always an important piece to keep in the back of your mind when you're trying to do that. And the what happens around Sinai in particular has clearly been sort of almost obscured, so that we're forced to dig and dig again and dig again and say, well, what really happened there?
It's pedagogical more than chronological.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so now, so that was, in terms of our show today, we first talked about Tu B'Shvat, now we talked about Yitro, and the
main event.
The main event, it's all set up. The main event now is the actual receiving of the Torah at Sinai, and especially receiving this thing called the Ten Commandments. What is the Ten Commandments? There's another seed or root metaphor there. This is something which is what? Chapter headings? Here's another question. Is it really said for the Jews? Because there are some commandments there, including the Sabbath, that is clearly for the Jewish people. Or maybe not. Maybe there's an element of Sabbath which is actually not in the particularity of Sabbath, but maybe the idea of a day of rest is something that went on to the nations. Really, most nations have accepted it, one form or another. But this is, you know, what is the Ten Commandments? They're not exactly every law, and yet there are even books written. There are even serious books written that tie every single Jewish law back to the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, I think that image of seed or source code, right, is an important one in the notion that what was received at Sinai doesn't really end. Right, one of my most favorite metaphors is it's not even really a metaphor, is to think about Rav Moshe Feinstein, right, the great leader of Orthodox Jewry in America up and through and he passed away in the 80s, I believe, right? You know, he was the first halachic decisor to see a microwave oven, right? And so they asked him, the Torah has a prohibition against cooking milk and meat together. So they asked him, if I put a piece of salami in a cup of milk and put it on the microwave on high for 2 minutes, what does God think about that? You think there was no microwave at Sinai? Moshe didn't put a little footnote in the Torah that says, by the way, when God makes a microwave. But what he did was he gave us a Torah that would allow Rav Moshe Feinstein to tell you definitively, yes, God is opposed to you cooking salami and milk in your microwave. Right? And so the Ten Commandments are what lies behind that. They're this source code that allows our engagement constantly with a changing world, but holding fast to the Torah which we were given and not simply abandoning it for some sort of new conception. And as you're pointing out, Rav Sadia Gaon wrote a book that ties together all the 613 commandments and shows how they each have a root in one of the 10.
Speaking of that kind of ability to synthesize modernity or changes into Torah,
to continue the process of revelation,
right, and the halachic system, I heard recently a talk about what blessing should you say on strawberries. Well, we all know strawberries are ha'adama, or they're
sure.
But many strawberries today are grown hydroponically.
Yes.
And it's Tu B'Shvat, you know?
Yeah, so we've got to
have a strawberry talk.
Should and we talk so about bugs as well, or no, we don't get that?
No bugs. So although...
No, this is now Chag HaTolaim. That's the new iteration of...
Why is that?
Oh, you haven't seen, like, every Tu B'Shvat, all these guides come out about what you can eat, what you can't eat, and by the way, half the 7 species are out. Apparently, you're not allowed to eat them. You never were.
My wife made a cake for my son's school today for Tu B'Shvat, and it was like... Earth, it looked like earth,
right.
And then there was all kinds of worms growing on it, like and snakes and worms. I'm like, Malka, it's the holiday of the trees, you know, not the holiday of the worms. She's like, they don't make candies in the shape of trees. Good answer. Anyway, so where were we?
We were, I have no idea. Oh, strawberries.
Oh, strawberries.
The blessing on strawberries.
So yeah, so like Rav Avadya Yosef is like, if you know for sure that this strawberry comes from hydroponics, say shakol.
It's a big machloket.
Say shakol. And he gave the other opinion. He said the other major opinion was like, look, right now most people think it's adama. It's from the earth. So say adama. But if it becomes famous that indeed it's all grown hydroponically, fine,
the
change it to shakol.
Right.
I was just like, you know, there's a rabbi talking about blessings and the strawberry doesn't come from the earth. No worries. We
can change that.
Yeah. You work with me, baby. You know, it's like it's a system that's malleable, that's ready to intake new information.
And not just malleable, it is meant to be engaging the world as it is, although there's a tension. We engage the world as it is, but we don't necessarily bow to the world as it is as a reality, because that's what it is to be a people who's participating in a conversation that's been going on for over 3,000 years. We know that the way the world is now is not how it will be in another 500.
Yeah. Yeah. This happened this morning at the Fleischer household. Sometimes we put on Jewish music for the kids.
Uh-huh.
And it's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody was about to look for another song. And then my son Elazar goes, no, leave it. Let it choose the next song. Because YouTube will
choose. Yes, I know.
And usually, you know, it's spot on.
Yeah, it has a sense of how to do a playlist.
And I was like, my son just said, let the YouTube choose the next song. And Malka and I were thinking to ourselves, oh, my God, like, that would have been meaningless to us as we were growing up, certainly.
Yeah.
And you know, my six-year-old is like, that's the most normative thing for him. And then we were thinking, like, what is it going to be like for them?
For their kids.
Yeah, what is that going to be like? You know, is it all speeding up to a place that's going to be completely unrecognizable to us?
It's a question that bears reflection at the right time. At the same time, one of the powers of the Torah, I mean, you think about it, here we are, here was an event that happened, well, and we happen to be in the Middle East, but those of our listeners are in America, very far away, 3,300 or so years ago, right? And by the way, it's very important to remember that revelation, by definition, is always parochial, meaning there were real people who spoke a specific language, who had to own their own life path.
I was thinking to myself, what language did Moses speak with his wife? What language did they talk to one another? Was it Midian?
I was wondering if it was Midianite.
Did Moses have a good Midianite accent?
I don't know. But you get my point. Is that this is one of the great barriers for the sort of philosophically minded to relate to the idea of revelation, which is like, well, but the infinite, it's, you know, revealed to the finite, that like doesn't work. And so this is why you have to appreciate the greatness of the conversation around this moment. That's why it's so important to return to this parsha every year, because you can tie the present into the past in a way which will get us to the future.
And here's a great verse to substantiate what you just said. Chapter 19, verse 9. Hashem said to Moses, behold, I come to you in the thickness of the cloud, so that the people will hear as I speak to you, and they will also believe in you forever. I don't know. That just strikes me. Like, they will believe in you, Moses, forever.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, of the Jews who don't believe, and then I'm like, you know what? We're going to believe in Moses forever.
And those who don't participate in the conversation.
Right.
Right? Because then it's not important. You know, there's another piece in a verse slightly before this, which is a famous concept, which I think is deeply misunderstood. And now I'm looking at verse 5. Right? And God says, you know, if you now hear me, you listen to my voice, and you keep my covenant, and you will be a treasured portion for me amongst all the peoples. Right? This is this notion of Am Segula, the chosen or the treasured people. But, you know, Segula is a funny word. What does it really mean?
Well, I relate to that word as from the word Mesugal.
Yes.
Able.
Yes.
Ability. You'll be an able body.
Not only that, but what does it mean, Listagel? Right? Listagel is to adapt. Right? And this is where you hear the power of what it is to be Skula, right? This treasured nation, this able and adaptable nations. We're able to take this Torah wherever it goes. It doesn't matter in 2,000 years from now, 2,000 years ago, here, there, everywhere. I mean, you know, I remember when I was in yeshiva, the question of like, what would halacha look like on the moon? Right, came up, and the only answer to that will be, well, we'll just have to wait till there are Jews there. But when there are, it will go there as well.
Right.
Right? And that to me is the most important definition of what it is to be Am Segula. It's not some treasured thing that God put in a box, etc. I mean, I don't think Jewish history really bears that out, except in our survival. But what it does show is that the sort of infinite adaptability which underlies the sort of hard forms of creation, and which is really the greatest expression of God's will, that creation should be in all of its forms, has one of its most important essences in the Jewish people and their relationship to the Torah.
And here comes the Torah. Here it comes. And Moses
down the pipeline.
Right. He's going to say, first thing, God says, don't touch the mountain. Don't touch the mountain. Stay away from this mountain. If you know, get ready for 3 days, and then it's going to be showtime. When it's showtime, don't touch the mountain. People are liable to get killed. And there's that commandment is made a second time. Even Moses protests a little bit. He's like, I've already told everybody to not touch the mountain. He's like, don't touch the mountain.
So what do you make of that?
I thought to myself that maybe it means that a person should know that there are things that are not attainable, and that there are places that you can't go, and that that's okay. Accept the fact that even in an ecstatic moment, there are things that are beyond you, and then there are knowledges that you won't be able to attain. And you have to also accept the fact that God creates the world, and He creates levels and people and levels and things. And to some place you can ask, you can beg, you can pray, you could do whatever you want, you could strive. But then there are places where it's like there's a boundary. Respect the boundary.
Right. Ultimately, that's what God says to Moses at the way end of this process, after the golden calf. It says, "Adam lo yirani v'chai." Says that man can't see me and live. Like, there's a place you can't go. And I would add to that that, you know, we live in a time where the text of the Torah that Moses sent to us down through the generation is under unprecedented attack. The deconstruction of the text and the high criticism and all these things. And like, I deal with a lot of this in my teaching here in Pardes.
Sure.
And one of the things that I try to give over to my students, without getting to the intellectual arguments about historicity and truth, is that, listen, just remember, if you were a scientist and you wanted to know what life was, and you decided, I'm going to dissect a cat in order to figure out what's going on there, you might learn a lot about the mechanism, but you have destroyed what you're looking for at the first stroke. In the same way, there is a line around Sinai. You can cross that line. You can get into the mechanism. Maybe you'll learn something. Maybe you won't. But realize that the wisdom and the taste of the infinite, which was given to Moshe to hand over to us through time, lies beyond that boundary. And when you cross it, it disappears. Right? There's a power in the mystery which our society has a hard time absorbing.
And I learned a new word trying to understand this concept that I didn't know before, which is Bimshoch HaYovel. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to touch the mountain. Where's that verse? You're allowed to touch the mountain when Bimshoch HaYovel, when
right.
the shofar blasts.
Right.
Long, it's a long blast.
Right.
Mshoch means like it pulls. It keeps
right.
going, keeps going. What it means is before God actually exits the mountain, there'll be a long shofar blowing, and he'll kind of like, then he will leave. Like,
right.
like, you know, like they do it in you know, when the president of Israel comes to the Knesset or something, like everybody has to stand up to let the important person leave, you know?
Yes.
It's like, recognize there'll be a shofar blast, a long one, and then God will kind of exit, or his presence will exit the place, and that's when you'll be able to touch it. It'll kind of come back to its natural state.
Because then by crossing it, you don't do damage to that precious moment where the finite and the infinite meet. Which just can't be understood. It can't be analyzed. It can't be taken apart. And you can't stand on the mountain when that's happening. You just have to. You have to stand in awe of it.
Okay, let's get to it then. Now we're talking about the Ten Commandments themselves. This is chapter 20, Book of Exodus. Torah portion is called Yitro, and the first commandment is, "I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of bondage." And that commandment is. First thing is important to say that this is now the God of law, and the God of judgment is the one who's speaking. And he says, I am the God of the Tetragrammaton, your God. I've taken you from Egypt. The commentators here say, look, God appears in different ways at different times. Okay,
yes.
And it's easy to be like there are different gods, God forbid.
Absolutely.
Right? And so therefore, there's a unity. And there's many great Hasidic stories about, you know, there was a great Hasidic rabbi who was the silent rebbe. He basically, they would just sit together and just be in silence for hours and hours and hours.
The Forker.
Right, the Forker, right. And they sat in silence on Shavuot night, just silent all the way till Shachar time. And he just said to them, like, he just said one line at the very end of this night of sitting in silence. He said to them, you know, if we could only really understand that God is one. And all the Hasidim said that when he said that, they were all like, for the first time in their lives, with full consciousness, they were like, God is one. They understood that God is one. And that consciousness is, it's not a simple consciousness. We really do.
But it's a redemptive one.
Right.
It washes over all the problems. It really does.
Right.
Because all the problems are rooted in the partiality of our understanding. Right. And that's important because, of course, our partiality and our particularity are what we have to offer to God. Otherwise, we wouldn't exist. But nevertheless, we shouldn't lose fact. We wouldn't lose sight of that core fact.
Yeah, that is the corest of the facts.
It's the one that gives us any context to even talk about the notion of fact.
Right. But it's also such a. We are created beings in a created world, and to really be able to fathom that the mess in the kids' room is just, you know, it's all a manifestation of godliness and it's all one. It's a tricky one.
Yeah,
it's not easy. The next one is Lo ye lecha Elohim achrim al panai. Don't have foreign gods before me.
And that's, by the way, the answer to the difficulty of seeing the oneness of God in the mess, or in, God forbid, worse things, the brokenness, the pain, right? Which is that, well, you have a choice. You can either see everything as from me, or you can be an idolater. That's it. It's the sharp choice that we all face. And to deny God and claim that there is no God is just a different type of idolatry. Let's not beat around the bush, right? And so basically, the pain itself has to be sourced in God, which is really the deep problem that people face.
Right. Here's, speaking of pain of God, this was what kept me thinking yesterday for a long time, which was the next phrase, which is, says, look, don't have any other gods, don't have graven images, don't bow down to them. I am Hashem, your God. I am a jealous God. I'm totally cool with that. I get that. I'm
a jealous thing.
That's not a problem for me. That's easy for me to understand. I'm a jealous God. I want you to love me. I want you to be with me. I don't want you to turn away to the others. I'm a jealous God. A zealous God. He's a jealous God, but towards him we should be zealous.
Yes.
This is an interesting English thing. Like, being zealous is good towards he who is... He's jealous for him to be zealous, okay?
Well, that's because he says, li kol ha'aretz, meaning he's the only God, but we're actually not his only people. We were the segula, but...
Right. That's right. He's got the whole world. He's got the whole world in his hands.
Hey, and that's a great phrase.
That's a great phrase. But check this out. Here we go. I will continue to punish people to the third and fourth generation for my haters, and I will do kindness for thousands, but really for 2,000 for my lovers and the people who keep my commandments. The Rashi points out here, it's 1 to 500, 1 to 500, okay? It's my anger and my judgment, harsh judgment, is one measure towards my kindness, which is 500-fold bigger. Fine. Here's what got me going. Listen, I. Who would want to hate God? Why would you want to, like, but to conceptualize that there are people who hate God. Now, I actually believe that, and I see it all the time.
No, for sure.
But I'm like, there is a category of people called God haters.
Yes.
That is weird. You're a created being. You owe everything to God. Like, and why would you, and God is, like the English language makes it kind of appear obvious, is part of good. Good comes from God. And he says the word, those people who hate me, I can almost feel him getting his feelings hurt a little bit. Like, why do you hate me? Like, there's people who hate God. Why?
I mean, I can't answer for the world, but I've experienced quite deeply in the work that I do that there's something within the human being that hates anything which we perceive as being above us. That we perceive as limiting us. And there's really kind of two ways we can go with acceptance. Remember, someone who hates God accepts the existence of God. It's very important to remember that.
Grandpa, do you believe in God after what he did to us?
Right, exactly. Exactly, right? I mean, like, someone who's an atheist could live a healthy, happy, and I think, frankly, blessed life, you know, because the truth of the matter is, especially in the world in which we live, it's not such a surprise. But someone who believes in God and hates is struggling within themselves with the fact that they are not the infinite. and that something which stands above you perforce makes you small, as opposed to what we were saying before is that
Moshe understood that. I got to challenge you on that. But you really are going to be on this earth for 80 years. Like, look at the other guy. You see, you get old and wrinkly, and then you pass away.
But you think that people that hate God don't hate others that are greater than them,
right? Or maybe they hate the fact that they're jailed in this body.
There's a lot. I mean, and listen, the anger, and I also want to make a very clear distinction: anger at God is not hatred of God. Anger at God is to me also a very logical and understandable reaction to much of the suffering and difficulty in life. Hatred presupposes the fact that I can judge God and find God wrong, find wanting, essentially. And yet I still feel, like you said, trapped. Something stands over me. I mean, I've had this discussion with people very close to me, students very close to me, who simply cannot bear the notion that there is something greater than them. And I always try to say, but that means that the infinite is above you. There's no limitations, right? Like, the more you rise up toward God, the greater you become. It's not like you're ever going to, like, get to some barrier and say, like, oh, this far and no further. I mean, like, the embrace of the infinite makes us infinite in our potential, at least. But no, there's something very deeply rooted there.
Even if the Torah would have said about in the narrative voice, and there are those that hate God, I would have somehow, like, God saying about himself, like,
yes,
there's those who hate me.
Yes.
It's like a very candid admission.
Yeah. And this, one of the tools for understanding this type of language is important to remember that our sages taught us that Dabar Torah B'Lashon B'nei Adam, that the Torah speaks in the language of humanity. And that doesn't just mean the linguistic structures, which is its own challenge. It means that the pathos that we hear there in some degree is the way in which we would feel. I mean God's unfathomable to us. But, you know, the greatest I hear, the greatest line in the whole Torah, think back to the creation, right? When people say, why did God create the world? Well, he gave us a little autobiographical hint. Because before there was evil, there was only good, right? But what's the transition between evil and good? Lo tov. Not good. And what's lo tov in the Torah? Lo tov hiyot adam levado. It's not good to be alone. And in that, you can hear that same pathos. That's God saying, like, really, I want you out there, humanity. In the same way, here, when God says, like, to those who hate me, and that's also the voice of Moshe and Am Yisrael and our history saying, like, those who hate. And we, as Jews, have seen the purity of hatred. It's a bizarre thing within humanity.
You know, you just struck my fancy there because of my inquisitiveness because you said, like, lo tov. And then I remembered in this week's parsha, we also have a lo tov. Like, what you're judging alone is lo tov.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, it's true. Wow, I didn't think of it.
Yeah, there's like, that's not good. It's not good for you to be alone up here.
That's a parallel that deserves some reflection.
Right. Hmm. Interesting. Okay, we'll have to do it afterwards. Let's keep going. We are running low on time now. But again, that's what cut me up. I was like, it's like God's like, yeah, there's my haters.
Yeah.
My detractors out there. Well, I'll get them. You know, but it was just like, and then I was like, God, but you're the boss. You created this world. Why did you make these haters? Or why did you, I don't know. It's just very candid approach. It wasn't even the evil ones, the ones that are evil and the dark. It's just like my haters. I don't know. It just boggles my mind sometimes, you know.
Listen, hatred is a unique quantity. It really is a, kind of like almost a black hole within the human spirit,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's a challenge. I'm challenged, frankly, by the references to hatred that we find in our texts as an appropriate response to certain things.
Ohavei Hashem sinu ura.
Right.
Lovers of God sinu, hate evil.
Sinu ra, I find a little bit easier, but at least no. There's a time.
Well, come on. That was more. He wasn't. That wasn't. That's not an affirmative commandment. He's reflecting on the world, like kind of like we're doing now.
Maybe. We can talk about it more later. But I think that you're putting your finger on something very profound.
Tough. Anyway, it was interesting. Okay. Next thing is do not take the Lord's name in vain, and the reason. And then it says God will not cleanse you if you take His name in vain. And this is kind of there's a very intense. Warning, stern warning, do not take God's name in vain. And the explanation here in the commentators is that you might think that just throwing around the name of God is no biggie. It's just something I said. God says, I take that seriously. I take your what comes out of your mouth seriously. Don't cheapen my name. Don't don't make it as though it's not what it is, which is really important in this world.
And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it was a turning point in human history when oaths no longer served a real function in service of justice and truth. Right? Meaning we all give lip service to the notion of, well, your word is your word.
Oh, your hand on the Bible type of thing is what you're talking
about?
Yeah,
but that's like a late stage description of it.
But it's a powerful metaphor.
It is a powerful metaphor.
I'm swearing.
But what I'm saying is that the idea of taking God's name in vain is a failure to appreciate that your words create worlds.
Right.
Right. And so words are so cheap in our culture.
Right. Like, let's just explain to people what we mean. Like, in our Jewish law, there is a whole, we just passed this tractate in the Talmud, which is called Shvuot, which is all about, like, when do you force a person to swear? We kind of believe you. We kind of don't believe you. Okay, here's a moment where you've got to take an oath.
And not only that, but you see a huge sort of cultural momentum. And when will we allow them to just pay up in order not to swear? It's like that one goes straight over the head of most Westerners. Like, what do you mean? Like, okay, I didn't actually do this monetary damage you're accusing me of, but I could get out of paying by swearing. But I'd rather pay, thanks. I don't want to take that oath.
Right.
Right? And it's just, I think that somehow if we could return the power of language and at its heart and center, the power of God's name to a vessel for taking ourselves seriously, for taking our role as human beings seriously, it could potentially transform the nature of our relationships.
The name as it's not just in the head, it's as it's said, the mouth is a very powerful thing. I was thinking about that, like if we could control our mouths, what comes out of our mouth, and also related to that is what comes into the mouth, which was, I don't think, you know, I don't know if humanity had to struggle as much as we have today, but certainly with kosher food, that's one aspect. Another thing is not eating junk. You know, the mouth is a powerful, powerful thing. And we in Judaism, we believe it's an action. Speaking is an action. Speaking is dangerous. Speaking can kill.
Yes.
Speech is important. Okay, speech is important. God's name is important. Next thing is respect, honor your father and your mother so that your days will be lengthened on the land that God gives you. So linked up here is long life, the land of Israel, and all with respecting your fathers and mothers. And basically, fathers and mothers are like, the simple and psychological and legal idea here is that respect your parents, you're going to respect God.
That's right. And it's important to note in terms of that tension of the particular and the universal that we're speaking about is that in the mind of the rabbis, it's the nations of the world who sort of exemplify this commandment. And so many beautiful stories in the Talmud about how we learn that specifically from Esav or from later stories.
Every day I'm at the tomb of the fathers and mothers, and that's Kibud Av V'Em right there. I'm always telling people that the reason I want you to give money to Hebron is because I want you to fulfill the real mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. I want you to really beautify this place of the mothers and fathers. But on top of that, there's a few heads around there. One head.
Floating around, right.
Yeah, the one head is the head of Esau, of Esav, who's just buried at Marat HaMachpelah because he honored. And this is one of my favorite Jewish things, which is, no, we don't mean that as a negative. Like, the fact that his head is there is like because he did a good thing. So a part of him deserves.
Part of him made it in. It's right. The best part after all.
So his head is there. By the way, the other head is Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth is buried with Avner ben Ner.
Just his head?
Yes, his head was sent to Eretz Yisrael. He was killed, I think, in Transjordan. Any case, excuse me, that's the end of the, that's the end of the kingdom of Saul.
Right.
And his general and his son are buried in Hebron in unity with a Davidic kingdom. Okay, and there's much more to be said about the respect, honoring of the fathers and mothers, but that's, you know, really, it's also respecting where you came from, that you weren't born into this world. Just like you didn't create yourself like those people that you were talking about. You're not the boss. You weren't even born unto yourselves. And those people that cared for you and brought you out of danger, which is being a child, brought you into this world. And I do, by the way, and here I want to give advice to listeners. Now, my children aren't fully grown, so the experiment will be seen later on. But I want to say, I tell my kids all the time, there's a mitzvah called Kibud Av V'Em. You've got to keep that commandment. It's not me telling you, that's the Torah telling you. And watch me, I do that to my parents. I don't say to them, like, you owe me respect. But I do say to them, this is a mitzvah in the Torah, so you have to act with me this way. This is not Kibud Av V'Em, this is Kibud Av V'Em. And watch this, I'm going to do it to my parents, and that's the way I've gotten here. and I'm passing it on to you. It's like
I bless you that it should be successful.
Amen. And v'chen lamar, and to all our listeners, not an easy thing, of course. And I think there is a rabbi in the Talmud. I get another great Jewish moment, right? There's this rabbi who's an orphan. He's like, whew, got out of that one. Because he's like, that's the hardest mitzvah in the Torah. And there's a whole, there's a many stories about how hard that mitzvah is.
Oh, yes.
And folks, the older folks listening to the show, I just talked about the children, but let us remember that we also owe our parents kibud av v'em. Remember that, like when your mom and dad sends you something a little bit annoying or say, remember that, like.
So if we're gonna go a little bit further, I want to add to this that one of the great pieces of wisdom that my wife received from her Rebbetzin, who was a specialist in raising children, was that as much as there's a mitzvah in the Torah to honor one's father and mother, that it's incumbent upon us as parents to be mochel akavod, to really let it go. Not in order to undermine that, but in order not to be a stumbling block in ourselves before our children.
Yes. Okay. That mechila, what is the English word for that?
To forbear, to forgive, to
not assert, to not
yeah,
assert.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
To not assert that. That's true. But I think that's when it has to do with the personal. I mean, to say, I don't personally need that. It's not because I'm now demanding of you to keep that commandment because I want you to honor me.
Yep.
I think there's certain things that you have to demand of them, not because they honor you, the person, but because they follow this commandment and that they should know about themselves. And I know many people who didn't do such a great job honoring their parents, and then they live with a lot of regret. Mm-hmm. You end up living with a lot of regret when that parent goes away, and you're like, I didn't, I should have. And that's something that you don't want, and you want to make sure your kids don't have that also, as much as possible. You know, yes, you have to be mochel. I agree with you, but I think you have to be mochel on the personal level, meaning to say, I don't need that covered. I don't need that covered. But and there's many stories about covered. For example, Rav Sabato once told us that when he was a young rabbi, so people would stand up when he walked into a room, and he was like, he felt very uncomfortable about that. Then he realized it wasn't me. It's the Torah that I am walking around with that I'm containing. But it's the Torah's cover. It's not me.
Yes.
I'm just embodying it. Any case, let's just finish off here. We have, let's just finish off with the last
knock
five commandments.
Knock off the last five. Everybody knows them anyway.
Yeah, which is, don't murder, darn it. Which by the way, for the pacifists out there, does not say don't kill. Do not murder. Do not murder. There are wars that are just. There are punishments that are just. Do not murder, which is unjust. Do not commit adultery, which in Jewish law simply is defined as really carnal relations with another man's wife. Do not steal, but it also means in this case, do not kidnap, right? Do not kidnap. Do not treat people's bodies
as an object in possession.
Right. Yafeh. Do not swear falsely. Do not swear falsely. And this is related to, on the other side of the Ten Commandments, well, in this case, it relates to the Sabbath, which is also an oath.
And a testimony.
And a testimony. But it also relates to number three, which is
not taking God's,
not
name,
taking
in vain,
God's
sure.
name in vain. And then it says, don't covet. Don't you covet. And on the simple level, it means you shouldn't covet your friend's wife, your colleague's wife, his servant, his
house,
his chandelier, of course. My wife is Hungarian. Hungarians and chandeliers, it's a thing.
Okay.
His ox, his donkey, and everything that's his. And the commentary here is certainly stay away from those kind of thoughts. But certainly don't plan in any way to acquire those things from the other person.
And it's something very profound in the fact that the sort of last element of the Ten Commandments raises the expectation of our ability to control our behavior to a completely new level.
To control our thoughts.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Meaning beyond the fact of don't do all these things, you also have to have an inner posture, which is one of what we call histapkut. You're satisfied with what you have. Don't look at other people in the world and want what they... Basically, if you want something, so go out and get it for yourself.
Right.
But don't look at other people with jealous eyes.
Right. I would add to that, and I thought this is where you were going, but I like what you're saying, but I just would add to that also, you can control your mind.
Yes.
It is in your within, more or less, within your dominion. And the rabbis also say, like, I think I heard this said by a rabbi once, it's like more of a rabbi thing to say, which is like, One look is understandable. It's the second look, right?
No, for sure. That's where real control look. Happens.
That's right. Okay, we're going. Basically, that is the receiving of the Torah. It's a super dramatic event, which I maybe didn't speak enough of, about how incredibly kind of the mountain's on fire. We also didn't talk about the Medrash, the famous Medrash that God held this mountain over our heads, kind of like, if you don't receive this Torah, you know, the whole thing.
We'll wait for Purim to talk about that.
That's right. We'll wait for Purim. Very good. And I just want to, there's more to talk about, including the fabulous verse that says, in every place that I shall remind of my name, I will come to you and bless you. Right? Mm-hmm. Wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I really like this very much, which is, now it's suddenly, it always comes back to the temple, the land of Israel. You're going to build an altar. At the end, it says, you shall not ascend my altar on steps, so that your nakedness will not be uncovered upon it, right? Make an altar for me, but make a ramp so that when you walk on the stairs, that your private parts don't sneak through kind of the pants, and it's kind of unseemly and all that. But on even another level, lo tale ba'alot al mizbachi. Ma'alot means you're also your
high level.
Yeah, your
there's a word for
your,
it.
Your best characteristics, your what's the word I'm looking for here?
Qualities.
Right, your best qualities, your accolades, whatever they are. Don't walk on my mizbeach, on my altar with your accolades. Look at me.
That's right.
I'm a really frum guy, you know. I learned Torah. Look at me. I'm really, you know, whatever that is. Don't, because what's going to happen if you do? Lo tegale arvatcha alav. If you show off,
you're showing how naked you really
are. Yeah, it's gonna show your dark sides, which we all have.
Oh, for sure.
And really under all this is also Moses. Here's Moses, who's really so humble that he even has no problem with this Torah portion being named by his father-in-law,
right?
Who gives him the hard time.
And this final image of the revelation at Sinai is very important also for what it connects to. Because here we had this sort of like the sort of thunder and lightning show, as you said, and the Big Ten. And then what comes after it in Parshat Mishpatim is this intensely detailed portion of how life is actually meant to be lived. And the altar, to a certain degree, is a physical metaphor for that connection. It's the place that connects heaven and earth. It connects the place that connects vision and manifestation. And therefore, it connects the giving of the Torah at Sinai and Parshat Yitro, and then it's unfolding in its incredible detailed particularity in Parshat Mishpatim.
The law is coming down.
That's right.
Gave you is chapter headings. These are important chapter headings. They're also mnemonics of sorts.
Elements of vision.
Right. You can, what do you mean by that? What do you
elements
mean
of vision meaning these are an ideal of how humanity, you know, should be.
Right.
And then in Mishpatim, we're going to say, and how do you get there? Well, if your ox strays into your neighbor's yard. And then the details are what actually make the bridge between the vision and reality.
It's interesting you said. I was going to say another thing about the Ten Commandments is it's visual.
Yes.
It's there's the two tablets.
That's right.
And you know the way that they have it in the movies? That's the way we have it also.
Yeah.
Like that's that one.
Yeah, they
like,
took one straight out of the text. Yeah.
Right, that's a fair one. But that's the way Judaism has it also. Like the way they have it in the public schools.
It was a theatrical moment and there was a physical item that Moshe brought down from the mountain.
Right. But I'm saying even the world of theatrics today basically, that's the one.
Yep.
We that's the one. And you know, and just this past Shabbat I saw an older gentleman wearing the tallit, the prayer shawl, and he's got one of those clips, you know, with the two tablets. And the two tablets are something I believe that there's elements in the Torah that are meditative elements. Meditate on those tablets. The next Torah portion, not a meditative element. This is the law book.
That's right.
You can use West, law to you have to
the
learn
analytical
the stuff.
Approach, right?
Right. But this way, just you have a vision of, and all them root back. That's exactly what this Torah portion is about. It's about roots, and the root of it all is here, the Ten Commandments. And we learned a lot. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to wish you again a great Etrog this year. And I want to wish everybody a great Etrog and whatever that Etrog means. I always tell my little daughter, you know, there's these yellow cars drive around from time to time. You know those cars that are yellow? Mm-hmm. Especially there's one by the Citroen company,
it's kind of
which
funny,
is yellow.
Huh?
And Citroen means?
Like citrus.
It's a Citroen is an Etrog.
It's an Etrog, yeah.
And I tell my daughter, I say, you see, why does this car yellow? Because somebody prayed too much for an Etrog, and it became this car. All right, folks, God bless you. I want to thank you so much, Rabbi Mike Foyer. I want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Oh, next week, shan't be with you.
Okay.
Unless you're coming out to...
Now you should travel safe and should have much success in bringing Chevron to the world.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being with me. Thank you all, folks, everybody. And we are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on the Land of Israel Network here at Pardes Institute. Rabbi Mike Foray can be reached at RavMike@thelandofisrael.com or RavMike at Facebook. And, of course, your other show, fabulous show, doing a great job recently. Really enjoying it. It's called The Jewish Story here on the Land of Israel Network. Folks, stay tuned. We've got more, a few more minutes here with Yishai, and we'll close out the show. God bless you wherever you are. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected. God bless you and shalom.
We as a people? Who are we as a nation? What does it mean to be a Jew in the land of Israel, as a Jew in Judea? What is our message to the world? We're finally back in our land, and we get to ask these questions.
Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to make Judea and Samaria an issue for the entire world to know that the Jews have a place in the world.
Israel Inspired with Arya Bromwitz and Jeremy Gimpel on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting this segment from Judea. And I'm joined by my fellow Judean, Malka Fleisher. Malka, welcome to the show.
Hi, Yishai. It's good to be back on the show.
We love having you on the show, including Grandpa Walter and many other people who have told me how wonderful it is when you're on the show. So here you are. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me, and happy day after Tu B'Shvat.
That's right. Well, yesterday, the other part that folks heard was recorded on Tu B'Shvat, but today is still the energy of Tu B'Shvat, especially because it was a blue moon, which means that it was one of these semi-rare second-day full moons. And did you see that, like, super moon?
I saw the super moon. I took the kids yesterday, and we hiked out behind our house to find the super moon because there's a mountain. You couldn't see it, but then we saw it, and it was super.
I saw that super moon. It was just a large and beautiful moon coming up over Jerusalem, over our old haunts on the Mount of Olives. And it was great to see the old city walls and the Mount of Olives. Big, big moon. And you were looking at it here in Judea, a little
That's
bit
right.
to the south.
It was very pretty. And it was a pretty day in general yesterday. We're having like a hot snap. Can you call that? I know you can have cold snaps. Can you have a hot snap?
It's not so snap. It's not that it's that hot. But it's dry and clear.
Yeah, it's dry and it's warming up. Anyway, I went outside with the kids yesterday because yesterday was Tu B'Shvat, the new year of the trees. And it's customary on Tu B'Shvat to do planting. And it's also like, you know, a thing where really kids get involved. And there's a lot of times events for kids, planting for kids. So it happens to be that my kids' school has a program with a local like farming project where they teach the kids all the names of all the farming tools, and they teach them the life cycle of the plant, how to plant plants appropriately and things like that, which I think is so cool as like an educational program. It's a class that they have once a week. They all go to this farm.
What's,
this
it like, called, what's it called like in American rural areas where they have that?
Co-op?
No, that club, that 4-H.
Oh, yeah, 4-H club. Yeah. Not exactly. There's no animal husbandry. But basically, it's a really nice thing where the kids learn about plants. Anyway, so they opened up for the whole community here in Efrat for people to go and plant. They're planting a mini vineyard. So we all went and planted Cabernet Sauvignon grapes. And they explained to us about grafting. And there's laws in the Torah about grafting. You're not allowed to graft certain things. But it happens to be that if you have two things of the same species, you are allowed to graft them. So they said that in Israeli wine, for example, they graft the different grape types onto like this really strong root, this really strong grape root, and it's totally kosher to do that. That's something I learned yesterday. And we got to take a plant home, and the kids hiked around a little bit and looked at these very interesting chickens. And so that was just a beautiful thing we did on Tu B'Shvat. The night before, we had like a mini Tu B'Shvat Seder where we ate different fruits, some of them fruits from the land of Israel, some of them not, just celebrating the fruits. And we talked about the concept of man being like compared to a tree. I went to the Shuk Machane Yehuda in Jerusalem, which is like the location to go get your special fruits. And the place was packed tons and tons of people buying all kinds of fruits, especially dried fruits.
So you were at the outdoor market?
I went to the outdoor market. It's very famous in Jerusalem. If you come to Jerusalem on a trip, or I don't know, if you live somewhere outside Jerusalem and you don't really know about it, you got to make Shuk Machaneh Yehuda a stop. It's just very, very lively with all kinds of fruits. And now it's a classic
Middle East market, outdoor market.
Yes, except it's been gentrified a little bit. In not an overly obnoxious way, I have to say. It's pretty nice. There's lots of really cool little restaurants and clothing stores, and everything's been kind of renovated, and it looks really nice. But it still has that like authentic Middle East feeling for sure. And I don't want to tell you, we're not going to talk about how much money I spent on dried fruits of various kinds and nuts.
I did see that there was a lot of dried fruits.
There was
a lot.
Well, we got a lot of different types.
Right.
And people like to make. Some people like to bring in like as many different types that they can.
Right.
Of different fruits, and you know say the blessing on fruits of the tree, right? And other people, they do it more simply, which is also a great way. And they just eat fruits from the land of Israel. There's seven species, the Shivat Aminim, the seven species of fruits and grains that are indigenous to the land of Israel. And people eat those and talk about the value and the beauty and the holiness of the land of Israel. And there's not like an official Seder. It's not like Passover where you have it all written down and, you know, you got your grandma's Maxwell House Passover Haggadah passed down to you when she passed away at the age of 111, and you still have her old same Haggadah that you use. The Tu B'Shvat Seder has never really been recorded, and it's something that's like in process still. I think people are still trying to figure out how they want to celebrate Tu B'Shvat, but sitting down to eat fruits is a classic way.
Right, but we definitely did. We did.
We did it.
We did planting and looking at the moon.
You got to plant outside the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs,
yes.
Yishai. That's pretty special in Hebron.
Yes. I posted a picture of it on my Facebook page, and one of the people wrote to me. She's like, "I remember planting with you when we organized a Rut Sheva, Israel National News trip to Hebron.
I remember that too.
And we planted this garden of the seven species. It's still
there. It's still there. It's doing great.
It's doing great. And just Malka, you know, this year what happened was is that the folks at Israel 365, Tully Weiss, he was like, "Yishai, we want to plant in Hebron. We've got some money here from Bible lovers from throughout the world." I'm like, "Let's do it."
Nice. So what'd you plant?
We planted big. We planted like three willow trees next to
Rata Machpelah,
and one
willow
one
trees
of these,
are nice. They're shady.
One of these trees that has these flowers that look like magnolia type flowers.
Ooh, yeah. Good
so
call.
Yeah, we planted there, and it was just, I don't know, it was just one of these things, and it just kind of happened. And I said Rabbi Tully gave me this prayer to say. It's on Facebook. You could see it, and it was you know, once again I find Tu B'Shvat to be a very special day.
Did you pray for your etrog, Yishai?
I prayed for my etrog, but more than that, this year, Malka, this is we talked about it on the first part of the show. I also prayed for other people. I kept saying to people,
"That's nice.
Blessed, you know, have a great etrog this year." You know, I kept saying people.
That's nice.
Now about 50% of people were like, "What are you talking about?"
Oh, that's interesting.
It's so weird. What a person like for me, like that, you have to pray for an etrog on Tu B'Shvat is like, it's like part of my DNA. Like it's like I know that so well. A lot of people didn't know that, and I just would bless people with an etrog. And I also thought about my beloved Rabbi Shimshon Neidel Hankohen, who this year together we went to the market and
went etrog shopping,
lulav shopping, and I just prayed for his etrog also.
That's
and
nice.
Hope to see him again next year.
Amen.
You know, and share with him, because he loves to buy an etrog. I mean, you've never seen a rabbi have God help him find an etrog. It's like you could see this is his mitzvah, this is his commandment. Very special rabbi. Any case, that's what's happening here in the land of Israel. Maka, I also want to thank a lot of the folks that make this show happen. We talked about northisrael.com/Yishai.
So cool for people who are looking for a chance to own a property in the land of Israel.
That's right.
It's good prices for now.
Good
that's,
price.
That's a good place
I
to buy.
I told people, somebody kind of made fun a little bit of it, a little bit said
Why?
To me. They're just like, you know, what are you, you know, trying to sell property? There's a million different property things. I said to them, you know, first thing, I'm not trying to sell property. I'm trying to help you find property. Second thing, just go to Google and type in North Israel. Just type in Tzfat, Carmiel. Just type that in. And then hit images. And then talk to me after that, okay?
Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
Oh, gosh, it's amazing. And there's really, it's the price point, the lower price point. So that's a lot of fun. NorthIsrael.com/Ishai. A good friend's at jbrick.com.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to say, no one wants to hear this right now because it's not Purim yet. And then it's when you really start to talk about it.
Yeah.
But Pesach is coming, dudes.
Yes.
Pesach is coming. And I think buying like a jbrick set, which is like a Jewish toys. There's not that many Jewish toys.
Yeah, get him a Jewish toy.
And it's just a very nice thing. I think that it's a really cool project.
You got to get him an Afiko Man. You know about Afiko Man? He's the Jewish superhero that comes at the end of the Passover Seder.
You should dress up as Afiko Man at the Seder this year.
That's right. Afiko Man. He like, dun da da da. Here he is, Afiko Man. And he's like, shh, I break the matzah. His little outfit is a broken matzah. In the middle, there's an A. Okay, Afiko Man. So that's definitely fun, and that's jbrick.com. And also, I'm very proud. Here I am right now in my living room, and I'm wearing a T-shirt, and my tits is outside. Here is a beloved, beautiful pair of Tehelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, Tehelet.com. This is already not, like, jbrick is a fun toy. Buying land in property in the land of Israel is 100% a mitzvah. But this is an overt Torah commandment that lives with you every single day, and that is the blue snail, blue dye, no, the snail, the broken snail shell, blue dye, Murex trunculi. That's right, and this is one of my favorite mitzvahs, Malka.
It's a great mitzvah, and I want to say that our little son Elazar Menachem.
You know, when I was in high school, I wasn't always wearing tzitzis. You know,
well.
And that happens in high school.
To people.
And I remember that there was a change in my life. And I remember it was in yeshiva when I put on tzitzis, but the tchelet tzitzis. And I was just like, it was just like this moment.
You got
moment.
Turbocharged?
I got turbocharged, but for life. I was like, awesome. I was like, and to this very day, I wear tzitzis. And this is my I'm a Jew thing. You know, I am a Jew. I wear
right.
Tzitzis.
In a sense, it's an even more Jewish thing to wear than a kippah. You know, you think of a kippah as like the really Jewish thing to wear. But the truth is that the kippah is not listed in the Torah,
no.
but the tzitzis are. The tzitzis are something that Hashem is like, do this. And I want to say that regarding Tehelet from Tehelet.com, my son has a pair, little Elazar, who's 6 years old. He has a pair of the blue tzitzis. I'm telling you, I have other tzitzis for him too here in the house because you know how it is with kids and they get dirty and everything. He refuses to wear the other ones. He refuses to wear the white string ones now. He feels very special to wear the blue string tzitzis. So they're at Tehelet.com. They have all the sizes, basically, from 3 years old, when the mitzvah of wearing tzitzis starts, all the way up till a Fico Man size.
That's right. I told you, yes, he's huge. I want to say to you that you're absolutely right. And this I learned from one of my friends. You know, some of my friends are my rabbis.
Absolutely.
By the way, on today's show, I'll get back to the second. Today's show, we learned about that even Moses has a rabbi, our greatest rabbi, our greatest prophet. He still needs his father-in-law to come into town and be like, that you're not doing it the right way. And I thought that was the most deep lesson. Like, before you get the Torah, your father-in-law comes to Moses. And Moses is like, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, Abba. I think you're right. You know? And just to have that everybody needs
everybody
a rabbi.
Everybody has a person on the outside who can give them a piece of advice. Even Moshe Rabbeinu.
Right. And if you don't have that, there's something wrong with you. You think you're God or something.
God forbid.
But you're not. And even God, one could say, has
God takes
Abraham,
advice.
He has Abraham and has, you know, these great people
who suggest otherwise.
Yeah. Who, as I think Rabbi Mike said on earlier part of the show, yank the chain a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
even the Kodesh Baruch Hu, God bless him. And I mean, he is blessed.
Blessed be he.
You know, the Eibishter, the one above, you know, the one that we can't really judge or certainly cannot fathom. He, too, has a kind of partnership with mankind. This is stuff we talk about with Rabbi Mike a lot. Any case, my good friend, Meir Eisenman, great tour guide. I think it's Tour by Israel by
Israel Meir. Israel
by Meir.com. He showed me that the children, the little children, the boys, should wear tchelet. And,
right.
and I went.
At first, we thought maybe only for Shabbat. But then Elazar was like, no. He just refused to. Basically, he has one pair of tzitzis, and that's what he wears every day. And he loves it. And we'll get him another one for Pesach.
We also talked earlier in the show about Janglo.net. That's great folks that really are connecting people to the information of the land of Israel. Everything from
all
news,
kinds of forums also forums, that you news. Can get information on.
You're just plugged in. That's basically you plug yourself right into.
They give a great email, by the way.
Yeah,
Janglo has a great email where they do like a digest of like all kinds of interesting news and things that are going on the site. I think that's pretty worthwhile.
Ooh, I don't get that. I'd like
you
to
should get
that.
It.
I want to get that. Okay, so Zev Stubb, creator of Janglo, please send me. He's a listener to the show. Shalom to. Oh. That's right. So Zev Stubb, shalom to, and thank you so much. And also, of course, we cannot but mention Hebron Fund. Come visit us in Hebron in the English language, tour once a week. Of course, if you want to support us, that's why the word fund is in there. But but you could just keep it on the, if you want, drop off the
subtle.
D, keep it to Hebron Fun, okay? And come visit us and see
there's
it for yourself.
There's so many things that are about to just like burst forth out of Hebron, all kinds of cool tourist things to do and all kinds of swag that's about to come out of Hebron.
That's right. We
want to
make
kinds of great stuff to buy at the gift shop. You want to load up.
I want to rip off a slogan that I've always liked about Virginia. Virginia is for lovers. The state of Virginia, for those of you from North America, from America, I want to make t-shirts that say Hebron is for lovers. Hebron is for lovers because really it's the mothers and the fathers. And there's love in the air in Hebron. Hebron is romance. Hebron is love. Hebron's togetherness. It's from the word chibur, uniting. And so therefore I really would like to do so. You know, and I think it also puts a smile on people's faces. And Malka, I do want to do a shout out to Ezra Gilbert.
Oh,
who's a listener.
Shout out.
Shout out to Ezra Gilbert. Who lives also in the north of Israel, and I just connected with him yesterday, and he's a listener to the show. So that's a lot of fun that he's on the team and all of you folks that are on the team. And in fact, I am very excited to see some of my folks on a very special upcoming trip that's starting this Saturday night for me from Israel. I'm going on a journey. A journey, okay? That journey is taking me to a flight to Los Angeles, okay? City of Angels. And then, which should be twinned with like Beit El, right? The house of God.
That's a nice idea.
When the angels going up and down.
Why don't we have a...
Yeah, we got a twin. We got a twin things. We got to do this. I really want to work on twinning. Remind me to write this down. Anybody wants to remind me.
I mean, there are
me.
Twin cities. There is such a concept here in Israel. There are, you know,
yes,
sister cities.
Yes, but I want to do more for Judea and Samaria twinning program. And I'm going to be going to Los Angeles. Then to San Diego for about a day and a half. Back up to Los Angeles. Then I'm going to drive to Phoenix, where I'm going to see a lot of my buds out in Phoenix. I'm going to see my friends Jake and Arthur alone, and also my
friends. Is that where turquoise, is there a lot of turquoise in Phoenix, in
no,
Arizona?
That's in Albuquerque.
That's in New Mexico.
That's in New Mexico. And I think I bought you a thing from there one time.
Yes.
And then I haven't seen you wear that in a long time, honey. I like your little system of not wearing stuff that I get you so that
I Malka has any jewelry.
Right, exactly. And then I'm going to the holy, holy, holy city of Vegas.
Oh yes. I think that is how, I think it's on the sign when you come into Las Vegas. It's like, welcome to the holy, holy, holy city of Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think I'm excited to study.
In fact,
the
I know
secrets.
That Cher performs in Las Vegas and she has a song about that.
Well, holy, holy, holy. I'm actually excited to learn the secrets of the Zohar with the mystical crew that hangs out in the basement of one of the casinos and keeps the world as one of the pillars of the world through their study of intense Torah in Vegas. But I am meeting the Republican Jewish Coalition there. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then I'm going
that
for...
That is going to be a lot of fun. I a little bit wish I was going to that.
Yes.
I think a bunch of Republican Jews getting together is going to be fun.
Yeah. I think it's going to be like those, you know, those two guys in the back of the Muppet Show. What do they think? They're running the country. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then from there, I'm flying to NYC. I'm going to go see my friend Jack and a few other people, maybe my friend Thane Rosenbaum, great writer, great intellectual. And I got a lot of friends to see in NYC. And, you know, it's always fun to pop into NYC, or also known as New York, for a little bit of time before heading back to, of course, the great Holy Land. Which we're living in. Malka, I want to also say one last thing, which is if anybody wants to watch some Tu B'Shvat film, I just remembered something that I made a great little film about a super plant, and I don't mean a superfood. I did a
Metushelach?
Metushelach.
He's the
this,
best.
That's right. This 2,000-year-old seed that was found. Many seeds were found in Masada, and Maka, we should buy like many DVDs of Masada and sell.
I went to Amazon.
They sell it.
Amazon.com. Right. I went to Amazon. Yes, right. I wish you guys were sponsoring us. Anyway, yeah. I went to Amazon and people are like writing this down. They're like, how do you spell Amazon? Amazon's like, no one lives without Amazon anymore. Anyway, I went to Amazon and I happened to see out of the corner of my eye, it was telling me to buy Masada. You know right, what I mean? Because right. It knows more about me than I know about myself. So it's like, buy Masada. It was $95. I don't know what's going on. There's a shortage of Masada.
I know.
You can probably buy it used.
I saw it for more than that.
If you want to have yourself a good old-fashioned cry, go buy yourself Masada.
I do not concur with that.
Okay, guy who never watches it to the end because he doesn't want to have a cry.
Okay, thanks for spilling those beans. Anyway.
basically, you can watch. It's a two discs, and right. You can watch the first disc with no bad feelings.
And
then do not watch the second disc.
Right, the second disc.
Although, if it's Tisha B'Av, the Jewish day of,
just watch
of
the
thinking
disc.
About destruction and mourning and feeling very, very sorry, then watch the second disc. And don't let your children see it because it's not violent, meaning to say you could theoretically let your kids see it, but it is a heartbreaker because it's the true story of Masada.
It's the same thing that I don't watch the second disc of Fiddler on the Roof, you know?
Yeah.
I don't need to see the second part.
Yeah, the first part.
It's great, you know?
Saitel, Matel,
tradition.
It's all good. We're fine. Right.
But anyway, back to Masada. They found these seeds, these date seeds there. And then this scientist named Elaine Soloway down in the Arava Institute. Where it's very hot. They fed this little seed some hormones, a little wake-up juice, and then it sprouted.
It made it.
And it's an original Judean palm tree. And you could see a great video about
that. Is it having
that.
Any babies? We should do a follow-up.
I should do a follow-up. I should fly down there and do a follow-up. I should do that. But
I would
check
love
it
to
out.
See. Maybe we could get, maybe Matushelach is having little babies of his/her own.
Yes.
And then we could get one, and then we could have a tree descendant from a 2,000-year-old Masada tree.
Judean tree. Masada's not so far away from here. Okay, folks, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Maka, thanks so much for joining me on the Yishai Fleischer show here.
It was nice to be back.
It's great to have you back. You know, I'm always inviting you to the show, and everybody's like, Maka, Maka, Maka. Anyway, happy Tu B'Shvat.
Thank you.
And may you have a great etrog and all the etrogs that you
want.
A rootful year. Well-rooted, well-fruited,
May your leaves be shiny and
that's
glistening.
That's right, glistening. May the God above give you strength. May you also nurture from the earth below. The whole thing, as we say, Shoresh Lemata Upri Lemala. Folks, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Yishai Fleischer Show. Please write me an email, Yishai Fleischer, no, Yishai at thelandofisrael.com, or Twitter, Yishai Fleischer, Facebook, et cetera, there are ways to connect, so be connected. It's about connecting. It's about connecting. It's about being part of this incredible story, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, and a global explosion of God consciousness. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, and shalom.